I'm happy now to welcome Kathy Kelly. She is a peace and justice activist. She's co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness and Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And she will be at the Unitarian Church in Santa Fe tonight, Wednesday at 7 o'clock, co-sponsored by Pax Christi and Veterans for Peace. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, hello, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you back. And your work in nonviolence and your work really illuminating what the American military machine is doing, you could say takes a kind of follow-the-money approach. When great amounts of money is being spent in Iraq, you are there. Where is your Iraq work today?
Well, we didn't want to walk away from people who had given us so much hospitality in Iraq. We stayed in Iraq during the shock and awe bombing and tried to maintain a presence there for a good year and a half after that. And then it became really impossible to remain without bringing trouble to people because Westerners were held in such suspicion and sometimes antagonism. And actually, I could walk down the street where I live in Chicago and be in touch with Iraqis who have had to abandon their homes, flee their security, whatever they had before the invasion and occupation. And of course, some had terrible memories of life under Saddam Hussein as well, but many of them have been quite traumatized and displaced, landing in generally low-income areas of cities in the United States and trying to put their lives together. And there are people in the communities across the United States who are, you know, extending a helping hand, but really there's never enough. You can't follow the money and find that it's landing in the agencies or amongst the community groups that are trying to help the people that have been so uprooted, really, because of invasion and occupation. We also, though, realize that the United States military has gone on to attack Pakistan, which we're not at war with, but particularly in the last 2 months, the drone attacks in Pakistan and the United States' insistence that the Pakistani government wage bombing raids and artillery attacks against various places considered to be, they say, Taliban strongholds in Pakistan have caused many people to be displaced. There were 2 million displaced within 10 days when I was in Pakistan in this past spring. I suppose, you know, Joseph Stiglitz, he's a Nobel Prize winning economist. And he, along with Linda Bilmes from Harvard University, has calculated that the cost of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is $3 trillion. And that would come out to $1,000 per person in the United States, so per trillion. So 1,000 per trillion, and the cost is actually conservatively $3 trillion. So that's $3,000 per person. And if you consider an extended family, maybe, you know, you might have three or four members of your extended family, then you're talking about a $12,000 expenditure. And that gets to be quite a lot for each person in the United States for these wars. What are we benefiting from? What are we getting? And is our security perhaps even being jeopardized because of the United States bombing and destruction of other people's homes in other parts of the world?
Tell us what you did and what you saw in Pakistan.
Well, we went to be as close as possible to people who had borne the consequences of the drone attacks, the unmanned aerial vehicles that were firing Hellfire missiles and dropping 500-pound bombs into places where there was a suspect who, you know, would never get the privilege of a trial or due process of any sort. And in fact, a lot of times they'd have the wrong spot, and it took 14 attempts to kill Bechullah Massoud. And then on the 15th, they did kill him, but the 14 previous attempts had been, you know, aimed at people that were oftentimes deemed to be innocent civilians by the Pakistani government. So when we got there, we realized that actually the larger story was that within 10 days, 2 million people had become refugees, having been told by the Pakistani military, okay, the curfew is going to lift for 4 hours. You better run for your lives, you know, grab your family. People were literally carrying their grandmothers on their backs, you know, pregnant women racing away. One woman gave birth to a child on the road. Families told us about passing many dead bodies and trying to dig mass graves on their way out of town. So it was a very panicked situation, and we went to visit people who certainly didn't all have the same view. Some were so angry at the Taliban that they hoped that the Taliban fighters would be completely removed. Others weren't talking at all about whether or not they'd had any contact with the Taliban. And others were just so very, very alarmed and concerned because they were close to destitution anyway. And, you know, what if the cow thirsted to death or starved? Or what if they had crops that would just be withered by the time they'd get back to their homes? And this, of course, did happen. So there's a tremendous, tremendous impoverishment and need for every kind of assistance in terms of Pakistan's development. But there's also an anxiety that if they get tied in as a client state of the United States, maybe that assistance won't go in the directions that would most benefit the neediest. Meanwhile, the Taliban finds that to be very fertile recruitment ground. You know, you can kind of do a Robin Hood number and say, hey, Islam doesn't want you to live this way. You don't want to live this way. Band with us and we'll scare these moneylenders and landowners right out of town. And so it's a complicated thing, but I think poverty is something that the United States ought to be looking at when it views Pakistan and Afghanistan. And instead, we're going to spend $1 million per soldier per year in Afghanistan.
The numbers are staggering, and as we've, it's funny, I just watched the film, I didn't see it when it came out, but I saw it just the other day, Charlie Wilson's War, and it was yet another example, including what we are continuing to live through, of the U.S. being very good at violence and really bad at the humanitarian things in those very same countries, both during and after conflicts.
Well, it seems that we have so much to learn from what happened to the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union pretty well bankrupted its country on trying to maintain a military dominance in Afghanistan. And, I mean, they were somewhat in proximity in terms of geography. I mean, here we are on the other side of the world. It costs $400 to get 1 gallon of gasoline from the United States to Afghanistan. And you might think, well, wait a minute, that's impossible. But by the time they pay various fighters not to shoot at the convoys and transport the gasoline over to Pakistan and up through Pakistan and across the Khyber Pass and then into various parts of Afghanistan, that's what the Congressional Research Service has calculated is the price for 1 gallon of gasoline that would go in either an airborne vehicle or a land vehicle. And every soldier uses about 22 gallons of gasoline. Well, meanwhile, you've got people who are desperately poor, women who are, you know, weaving rugs all day long, trying to get enough income to feed their children if they're, you know, if they've been widowed or if the man in the house is away fighting with the military. And who's going to take care of the children in the daytime? You know, little ones tend to get restless and run around, and women are so desperate they give opium to the children, barbiturates to the children. I mean, these are situations of high desperation, stunted growth, impure water. 30% of the people have no access to clean water. There are 10,000 villages in Afghanistan. And, you know, the idea that the United States would be able somehow to go into all of those villages and prevent the Taliban from taking hold, you know, we might be able to go into the village of Marja tomorrow and the United States would say, okay, we'll hold this village, but the Taliban are long gone and they've gone to the next village or town. And so it's a kind of a preposterous idea that the United States is going to do what the Soviet Union wasn't able to do. But somebody's benefiting from this war. Some companies and corporations undoubtedly are benefiting them. You know, Blackwater and Halliburton. Well, Blackwater changed his name to Z, and Boeing and General Electric, General Dynamics, Martin Marietta, Lockheed. These are the big defense and security companies. But I don't think it benefits the United States people. We need some Congress people and some senators who will say, hey, I'm going to get out ahead of the curve and start, you know, teaching people about this, like Chuck Hagel did with regard to Iraq, and gain the respect of both progressives and, you know, people that are independent thinkers.
The stories that you tell from the ground, whether it be in Iraq or in Pakistan, are stories that are very important to appeal just basically to the humanitarian instincts of ordinary Americans. Are you able to get those stories out? They certainly do not seem to find their way into the mainstream media most of the time.
Well, sometimes you have to look to other media. Ajaz Frost Press told a story that I often tell audiences about a man who was a brigadier artillery officer in the Afghan army. He lived in the province of Khost in a small town. It was called Ali Dawah. And he was working with the United States in the Afghan army, but while he was away, somehow bad information was given to U.S. troops, and they believed that his home was one that which should be raided and attacked. And when the U.S. soldiers did what they were trained to do in places like Fort McCoy or in Irving, California, they train in model villages. You kick in the door, you go in with dogs, you have your guns aimed, and if anybody resists in any fashion, then you hogtie them and you take them away for interrogation. Well, in this instance, the family members were so terrified that they ran up to the rooftop. Well, when they burst out onto the rooftop, on the opposite roof were other soldiers who were under instructions, and they opened fire and they killed General Khan's wife and his brother and also his 17-year-old daughter, Nadja, his 15-year-old son, Aimal. And then his cousin, who was 9 months pregnant, heard the racket, and she came running down the street, and soldiers opened fire on her, and the baby in her womb was riddled with bullets. Well, when the U.S. military commander realized that this terrible, terrible tragedy had occurred, he, of course, had to write the letter to the general, the letter of apology. And you know, he said, "We're sorry. We're so very sorry." And I believe, you know, certainly there's a great deal of sorrow that's felt by people on the ground. But we need to feel that sorrow here, to recognize that we are a nation at war, that there are people every day who are bereaved, whose lives are forever altered, who are maimed, their children are sometimes dismembered by drone airplanes that fly in the sky and don't even have a pilot in them. When the drones attack, one friend told me that they try as best they can to get the survivors and carry them bleeding and wounded to the roadside and flag a car down. But in one case, this friend told me that the car sped up. The driver tried to get away as fast as he could when he heard what had happened because he thought he might be the next target. Because these drones are still flying in the sky. And I mean, I was in Gaza in January of 2009, and the Operation Cast Lead was going on. And when you hear those drones flying overhead, you think, wow, you know, they're really mapping out a target. Maybe it's us. Maybe it's tonight.
Tell us more about your work in Gaza.
Well, I think there are many people now across the United States who are aware that Gaza has been under siege, and that for 22 days last year in 2009, and beginning December 27th, but lasting for 22 days, the Israeli Air Force pounded Gaza. When I was there, a bomb exploded once every 11 minutes at night, from 11 at night till 1 in the morning, and then there was a lull, and then it started up again from 1 until 3 a.m. You hear this, you know, crashing explosion or a sickening thud. And even I could begin to tell, well, that was probably an Apache helicopter firing a Hellfire missile, and that was a 500-pound bomb being dropped by maybe an F-15 or an F-16 airplane. And people had nowhere to go, nowhere to flee. Gaza's kind of like one big prison. And one thing I thought of is, you know, that many people would say, well, you know, the people in Gaza were importing weapons through tunnels, and I don't have any proof of that one way or the other, but I wouldn't be surprised. There were 1,300 tunnels, and it's through tunneling that all the goods that go into the marketplace are generally delivered, and it costs a great deal of money, and it's a kind of a demeaning way to, you know, burrow through the ground to try to get things in. But as I say, Gaza's been under a very tight siege that the Israelis have imposed. But one thing I think of is if you were to build a tunnel, and only through that tunnel could the United States weapons that go to Israel be delivered, that tunnel would have to be the size of the Grand Canyon. I mean, the United States every year is equipping Israel. I mean, Israel already has 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons that they don't acknowledge, so there's no weapon inspection in terms of their nuclear arms. But they also get from the United States D-9 bulldozers to knock down houses and uproot crops. They get huge helicopters that are weaponized, and they get F-16 aircraft, and they get the 500-pound bombs and the Joint Defense Ammunition Kits and many, many cluster bombs. And all of these weapons are, you know, part of the expenditure that the U.S. has to make. Just between 2007 to 2017, the U.S. is committed to spend $30 billion for military procurements. And Israel buys some of that military material from U.S. companies, but then that makes us more and more dependent on defense spending in order to maintain our economy.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly. Many people who voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and who were delighted when he won voted partially for reasons of precisely the issues you're talking about, overspending on war, overemphasis on war. How is President Obama doing?
On the campaign trail, President Obama said there would be an uptick in military spending under an Obama administration and that he would fight the war in Afghanistan and try to win that war. I think he thought when he talked of a dumb war that Iraq was a dumb war, and you got the impression that maybe the thought was that Afghanistan would be a smart war. And so I think we can't fantasize about the president that we have. I think he's more thoughtful than other presidential candidates would have been, and that's valuable. But I don't see that he's educating the U.S. public to better understand, for instance, what we're facing in Afghanistan. You don't hear him explaining that there are, you know, 10,000 villages in Afghanistan, and that even according to General David Petraeus's counterinsurgency manual that Petraeus helped write, if you're going to wage an effective counterinsurgency campaign, you're supposed to have, for every 1,000 residents of a country, 25 soldiers. Well, that would mean you'd need 600,000 soldiers in Afghanistan. So why is the U.S. fighting in Afghanistan? We're obviously not trying to wage a counterinsurgency campaign effectively, one that would, you know, end at any time soon. If we're short 500,000 soldiers, we're, you know, at the most they're only going to have 100,000. What's the point? And I think, you know, the president could be much more transparent, maybe acknowledge that the United States is already in a cold war with China over control of pricing and flow of resources. And maybe it would be time to educate the U.S. public to say, you know, maybe we need to start using our scientists to create alternative sources of energy, wind energy and water energy, and begin to really redesign our lifestyles so that we're not so dependent on car culture, so that we really can become a country that would be beloved all around the world because we'd be trying to share our resources with other people and become experts in water purification and solving problems with water scarcity and disease. I think the American public would give President Obama a great deal of support if he moved in that direction. But instead, we're told to be afraid. Be afraid because the bad guys, you know, whether it's Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, might come after you. Well, this is silly. I mean, Barbara Boxer said in December that there are less than 100 Al-Qaeda fighters in Afghanistan. Less than 100. And if we want to better understand who are the Taliban groups, a lot of times these are young men who can't get a job. They don't have a very good education or maybe are illiterate. They want to maybe have some adventure in life, feel like they're serving the needs of their community, and they're maybe even told by their family, you know, we don't want to be in a hock to the money lender or the landlord or the corrupt courts that don't serve us. And maybe some of these groups that say that they have the answer, maybe they're right. Well, that's all related to poverty. And if the United States insists, as George W. Bush did, that money that we gave to Pakistan, for instance, under the years when Pervez Musharraf was the dictator, had to go toward military expenditures, we gave $11.9 billion over an eight-year period to Pakistan, and $8 billion of it was spent on the military, then we're not solving problems of poverty. And I think President Obama is a very smart man, and cares deeply about the future for next generations, but we're already $1.5 trillion in debt to China and Japan, much of it because of our bloated defense expenditures and our military budget that's like a demonic suction cup. And the new budget has us spending $2 billion a day on the war. And it's going to mean $1.6 billion more dollars of debt. So this means that the children's children they're the ones that are going to have to pay for all of this military spending. And for what? What does it get us? There's much more death and destruction caused by fatalities on the highway or by people's addictions to alcohol or smoking or, things that have happened here in the United States because of hurricanes and things that, are unpredictable. But, how many people in the United States have been killed by terrorist acts that it would warrant spending $2 billion a day on this global war on terror?
Kathy Kelly is a peace and justice activist. She's co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness and Voices for Creative Nonviolence. And once again, she will be here tonight at 7 o'clock here in Santa Fe, sponsored by Pax Christi and Veterans for Peace, and she will be at the Unitarian Church on Barcelona Street in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and let's get you back on the radio again soon.
Oh, well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. I hope your listeners can both come tonight. Maybe also check out our Peaceable Assembly campaign. That's what we see as the answer, the Peaceable Assembly campaign at vcnv.org.
vcnv.org. Thank you so much, Kathy.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.